This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Anchor. If you don't know what Anchor is and you're thinking about starting a podcast, you should probably find out what Anchor is, because Anchor is a free way to host your podcasts. It also gives you creation tools like the ability to record yourself, record with other people, edit as well, and do it from your phone or your computer. You don't need to go buy fancy tools to start. You can start with Anchor. And you can hit the nice distribute button, and it's going to send it out to all the places you want it to be, like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, and more. In addition to that, you can make money from your podcast with no basic listenership. In other words, if you only have 10 people because you're just starting, you can still monetize that. It's really hard to find a better place to start. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm and get started on the crazy podcast journey.
God, I hate my PC so much. I can't. I mean, I know it's not. It probably not isn't great to start with a gripe, but this thing is so frustrating.
Well, you had to restart it before we could even record, so that's why it's on the top of your mind.
Well, I had to restart it twice. The first time I had to restart it was just to get Trello to sync properly, because for some odd reason Microsoft Edge does not like to sync. Non-proprietary, like Todoist and Trello kind of sync whenever they want to, as opposed to on my Mac where they sync in real time. So that's pretty monumentally frustrating. And then after I got Trello to sync itself, then Skype killed itself, so I had to restart it again. So it's been an adventure, dude.
Always is with the PC, it seems. Actually, I have been relieved of a few frustrations with my PC this week. They set out an update that fixed my battery problem.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought you had chucked it out a window or something. So now you no longer have a PC problem.
That would be the quickest way to solve all of the problems. Well, at least now I can go somewhere with my Surface and not have to bring a power cord.
Yeah. Wow, monstrous.
Speaking of Trello, I just wanted to tell everybody that we're using that for live communication during the show now.
Yeah, which is interesting because I'm seeing you move things as we're talking about them. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, we're making show notes and we have topics preset within Trello. But then the reason we're using Trello is because, for example, if I were to bring up one of the topics in my column, I can click and drag it over to topics discuss, and then Lamb can see that live, which makes this whole process a lot easier, I think.
I'm also presetting the ability to add cards as I talk about them too, so we'll see how that works out.
It's all about practice, I think. Practice and the right tools.
Yeah.
You were going to say something before I interrupted you.
Oh, I don't even know. I mean, it was probably something gripey about PCs again. maybe about how it randomly chooses when it wants to... I'm running into your device problem, except it's not with a headphone jack, it's with the USB cable. So now, like, it sometimes it defaults to the microphone, sometimes it defaults to the computer microphone, and I literally have to go in there and change it back, and it's just annoying. It's just incredibly annoying.
I wonder if, you know, like, all of our listeners, there's got to be some of them out there that are, like, PC lovers, that prefer PC over Mac. I want to hear from them. Like, what's the deal, guys? Like, do you guys have this many problems? Or is there like some magic formula that the rest of the world doesn't understand about PCs that only an elite few do?
You know, to be honest with you, I was a pretty heavy PC user, I guess maybe 5 or 6 years ago. When I was much more in the gaming world, I built, you know, I was one of those guys that built my own monstrous gaming PC. And I was operating it on Windows 7. And after I had customized Windows 7 and optimized it for all of my purposes, it actually worked really, really well. So I imagine that the power users on any version of the OS, you know, whether it's Windows 10 or Vista or 7 or whatever it may be, have their computers primed to a pretty good level. I just haven't spent the time, nor do I ever see myself spending the time to do that with Windows 10. And I imagine that most users will not. So I don't know how or why the level of capabilities built into the OS that isn't easily accessible to most normal people.
Yeah, because it seems like a considerable amount of the problems that I have, I mean, there's no manner of optimizing my Surface that's going to make any difference, because the device, I mean, like, what are you going to do to that device? You know, it's not like I can add anything to it. I can soup it up at all. And the fact that it's not working, it's a new device, it's not working with this top of the line operating system because there's poor coding going on. And I mean, no matter how powerful your PCs are, these people have to be running into the same problems.
Oh yeah, I don't doubt that. That's got to be, it's got to be a constant struggle for, you know, and especially for the early adopters too. You know, people who are just right out of the gate using the latest version of Windows 10. I imagine that's got to be pretty monumentally frustrating because you're basically guinea pigs. And to a certain extent, if you're an early adopter, you always run the risk of being a guinea pig. I just think that there should be at least a certain level of crispness that can be expected from an operating system upon release that is at least marginally acceptable. You know what I mean?
Exactly. I don't know. It just seems like maybe Microsoft's focus is just in a different, completely different place. I mean, not that Macs are perfect, but it seems like for the most part, the Mac OS focuses on working on a consistent basis. And yeah, you can't go in, you can't soup it up and do all these things that you can do with the PC, but you know, it's back to our Honda argument. Like, you buy a Honda and it runs for a long time. I don't know. I guess we should talk about something other than complaining about PCs.
Well, tell me why you're on antibiotics, man. What happened?
It's nothing I want to talk about with our viewers or listeners.
Okay.
Yeah.
You feeling okay?
Yeah, right. I don't know. We'll see once they kick in. I'm sleepy. That's the main thing.
Yeah, I'm on some kind of crazy allergy med too, so I'm feeling pretty loopy at the moment as well. So our topic should be bouncing all over the place right now. Should be fun.
It's a good thing we have this Trello thing set up.
Yeah, let's see how that ends up helping.
So did you get a chance to play around with Text Expander at all?
I did not. I mean, I watched your tutorial videos, and then I checked out a few random reviews, and I downloaded it, but I haven't actually had a chance to mess with it yet.
I've known what Text Expander was for a long time, but I don't think I knew what it was, in the sense that, like, I had a general idea, but I didn't know the capabilities that this thing has. It's mind blowing to me. I always thought it was like, I'm like, oh, you know, it's like, it's that's already built into the Mac and already built into iOS, where, yeah, I can type in a shortcut and it'll fill in my email address for me or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, if I type in EM1, it'll fill it in. Yeah, Text Expander does that too, but Text Expander does so, so much more. Like, for example, every time we publish one of these episodes, I post it on Reddit, and then the Reddit forum has a specific format that they want. And 80% of it is repetitious, in the sense that it's about the show, not about the particular episode. Mm-hmm. And so basically I'm copying in 80% of something, and then I'm going in and I'm changing the other 20% every week. And that's not a huge deal. You know, I had it saved in OneNote. Well, with Text Expander, I can save that into Text Expander, and then I can set it up to where it's called a fill-in form. So basically when I drop it in, you know, I type in whatever the shortcut I have for it, while I'm in Reddit. Boom, it fills everything in. Then I have a pop-up, and it asks me to fill out the 20% that I'm missing, and then boom, it puts it all in there for me.
Mm.
And it's just incredible. Just incredible the things you can do. Like, for example, in the videos, you know, they're showing people using it for emailing their clients. You know, okay, you have a standardized letter form that you want to send to your client, but the product and the customer name are going to change every time. Use a fill-in form. Boom. Fills in the whole letter for you. You type in the customer's name. You select the product. Email goes out to them, and it's personalized. And it only took you 15 seconds as opposed to a couple minutes.
How much pre-hand setup work do you have to do in order to make it so that it recognizes all the things that you're describing?
All it is what you type in. So it's literally like, it's as fast as you go in. On the PC, you have to use the browser. They don't have like, the app isn't, it's not a standalone app. It works throughout Windows in all of the apps that you use. It works, but they don't have a standalone app for editing your shortcuts, which is not a big deal at all. But you go in basically, and you know, you want to make a new one. You go in, you go, okay, let's make a new one. Here's what I wanted to say. When I use my shortcut, here's what I'm going to title it so I know what it is. And here's a shortcut. Save. Done. That's it. And then the fill-in stuff isn't much harder. You just say, oh, I need a fill-in thing here. Okay. And it's all it is dropping short codes in, but it's dropping the short codes in that fills the stuff in for you. And it's, I mean, for things that you're typing over and over again, for example, how often do you type http://? A lot, right? Well, make a shortcut so that when you type in HTT, it fills in the rest for you.
Interesting. That's crazy.
All of those little seconds right there. I mean, imagine how much time you're going to swallow back.
Yeah, I mean, just from that alone, it seems like for me, it seems, you know, the difficulty for me is that the initial understanding of how it works seems a little daunting. And I think that's probably the reason why I've shied away from trying it. But I imagine once you get into the swing of things, like how long did it really take you to get used to the interface and how it worked?
4 minutes.
Okay, I'll download it.
It's not what you think it is. It's not as difficult as you think it is. It's literally, and if you watch those tutorials, like, because they have great tutorials on their site. Somebody else did them for them, but they're like, you know, 3 to 5 minute tutorial, like, oh, how to do a fill-in. Once you get like a minute in, I get the concept. You might watch the other 2 minutes just because you know they're going to show you like 2 more examples. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I mean, it's so basic in the time saving, and we can share stuff. So, for example, I can all the stuff that I set up for this podcast, all the shortcuts I set up for this podcast, I can share it to your account. So you can use all of those as well.
And, oh, that's cool. Okay.
And they used to be, there was a lot of hubbub recently about, so Smile's the company that makes it. The Back to Work guys are big fans of this. That's why I know a lot about it. They recently changed their model. So Smile originally had Text Expander as you purchase the app, you use the app forever, you know, whatever they call it, legacy, I guess. Now they just changed to the subscription model, which is like, it's like 4 something a month.
Sure.
And people freaked out, and it's kind of ridiculous and silly, but you know, whatever, people are going to freak out about anything and everything, which actually transitions us to a topic that is worth mentioning as well. The Instagram rebrand and people freaking out about a rainbow icon.
Yeah. I think it's so inconsequential. I mean, don't get me wrong. The interface changes are more consequential to me. They're, you know, for a guy who uses Instagram for quite a few different purposes, very few of which are personal, having a consistent interface is kind of nice. And especially from my perspective, I felt like the things that changed didn't need to change. For the first thing that was a little frustrating to me was how messages worked or comments worked within the messaging feature, not the messaging, in the comment section. If you tagged another person's name, it now defaults you to sending them a personal message or sending them the image itself in a direct message versus just tagging them directly in the post. And that doesn't seem like a big deal, but it's an extra 2 clicks for me on my phone whenever it is that I want to share a post with someone or tag someone in a post. And that's kind of annoying. That's one of, you know, a couple of different features that are different from what I'm used to when it comes to how Instagram's interface allows me to communicate with other people within the scope of a post. So, I mean, I don't care about the icon. The notifications are a little more bubbly and happy. So I guess for pure visibility's sake, it makes it easier to see the notifications on your phone or separate them from other notifications. But overall, I don't really care.
I'm not going to lie. I kind of dig it. Like it stands out. I have so many green and white and blue apps on my phone. I mean, like, it seems like everybody has got to make an icon that color. So to have a crazy different icon, sweet. It's in a folder. I have it hidden in a folder. I look, I'm like, there's Instagram. I can spot it while it's tiny in the folder. I'm cool with that. But in the long run, even if I didn't like it, I don't care.
Yeah. It's a minor point. It doesn't change functionality at all, and it doesn't ultimately affect how the UX is. So I don't really care one way or the other.
And you know me, I don't really care about Instagram in general anyhow.
sure. That's true.
I use it as a photo poster. That's it. It's not a social media to me. It's a tool.
Yeah. And I can't remember the last time I really took Instagram seriously as a form of communication among friends. Like I might post on my personal Instagram once a week at best now, you know what I mean? Versus how I use it for business, where I have schedules and I'm using Hootsuite and all that kind of stuff. So Instagram's interface is almost irrelevant to me at this point.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. Most of this stuff is irrelevant to me in the long run. It's like, one dies, one changes, whatever. You know, it's that market, it's going to, you know, something croaks, another thing will pop up. It doesn't matter. We're just going to spend our lives jumping from apps to apps. People are looking for like these. They're looking at this stuff the wrong way. They're thinking, you know, like, oh, this is going to be with us forever. No, it's not.
No.
There's no way.
I mean, even Facebook is not going to be with us forever, or at least Facebook in its current form.
And they have the biggest chance.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, to be honest with you, I have a feeling that Facebook's staying power will still be pretty good going into the next decade. But I think it's a limited, clunky interface, and I think ultimately it's going to evolve. Some other company is going to evolve a better version of social networking that we'll all latch onto. You know what I mean? It's the nature of this kind of technological environment. There's almost no true mainstays other than hardware, and even the hardware has a tendency to evolve past a certain obsolescence, and then we adopt the next thing as what we consider to be everyday technology.
I think part of my thing too is like social media to me was always a thing to share, but it was never a thing to communicate to me. I think that's the problem I've always had with Facebook. It's like when you post something, all of a sudden people have opinions on it. And I have problems with people's opinions, but it's not necessarily that's what I'm not trying to open a dialogue every time that I share something. Sometimes I'm just like, this is cool. And you might like looking at it. And that's it. And it's, that maybe was a kind of a jerk way to say that. And I didn't mean it like that. But I mean, from the business standpoint, not from the way people use it, because people are going to use it the way that these businesses set it up, you know, regardless. But the way that they set these things up is they want us to believe that they're bringing us together. They're not bringing us together. They're allowing us to share things. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, to that end, you know, like, for example, going back to your Instagram thing about how it wants you to directly message now, because it's trying to become a messaging app in some sense, right? That's why it's doing
it.
They want that, because when you direct message a post to somebody, they're all jumping on the Snapchat thing. It's like, why does Snapchat work? Why is Snapchat successful? Oh, because when you send something to someone, they have to look at it. If they look at it, they saw it. You know, whereas everything in Facebook is passive, it has a more active manner. So by forcing people to, or not forcing, but trying to steer people into direct message, they're trying to grab a little bit of that magic.
Yeah, and there's definitely a forced interaction there too. And I think that, you know, it's funny because when I was pretty critical of Snapchat when they turned down the multi-billion dollar deal to purchase them way back in the day, and now I'm now finding myself going back on that. You know, maybe it was a very smart decision for them to hold on to their interface and their functionality. And I mean, don't get me wrong, though. I don't know how much of it is just incredibly intuitive foresight and just dumb luck when it comes to the business world. But I definitely do think that they did make a right choice now by holding on and not selling at the time in which they were offered the deal that they were offered. So it's interesting, though. It's I'm curious just as to what the landscape is going to look like now that they've gained such a strong and rabid user base.
Yeah,
so we'll see.
It'll be interesting to see how they end up monetizing, because other than within direct messages, there's not really a way to link to other things. So you're not going to be sending mm-hmm. people the products. And I understand, like, it's a content creation thing. It's very much, in a way, it's like YouTube, in the sense that, you know, like, you're viewing this. But at the same time, even among YouTube users, there is a necessity for notes within and links within the description. So video doesn't always fill that gap 100%. So how they're going to monetize that will be an interesting thing. They're getting some very interesting deals. They're making some very interesting influential choices. I think they're changing the landscape a lot. But they might run into the Twitter problem of, where's the money coming from?
Sure. And it's interesting, too, like in describing, you know, because that was one of the first thought experiments that popped in my brain when Snapchat was starting to roll back into its prominence was, you know, how are businesses going to use this in order to monetize? And I think that the only place I've seen it used really, really well is, you know, with companies allowing certain people to take over their Snapchat channels. For example, there are golf companies in the golf world that allow certain golf pros to just basically take control of their Snapchat for a day. So you get to see a much more personal view of their lives. It's actually a pretty interesting way to define your brand and to show off the people you endorse. You know, it's pretty cool, actually. So, you know, for me, it was really interesting to see how certain golfers went about their days when it came to tournaments or preparation or whatever it was. So for me, that was actually a really interesting glimpse into not only the business itself, but the people who support that business. So I actually find it to be I actually don't think monetization will be that difficult. In a lot of senses, I feel like it's going to be a very strong loss leader with very, very little downside and a lot of upside.
I think there's an inherent intimacy to Snapchat that, I mean, like, even the first time, like, I pulled that app and I'm like, oh, I don't know if I want to, you know, this was way before I started vlogging, but I was like, I don't know if I want to talk to the camera. And there's an intimate thing there, and leveraged correctly, it's very powerful. I can figure out how brands are going to make money off of it. I just mm-hmm. don't know how Snapchat's going to make money off of the brands.
Sure.
You know, like, I think that, I'm sure somebody's doing it, but, like, you know, fashion shows and stuff like that on Snapchat, amazing idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Imagine the stuff, you know, like anything product-based that's on Snapchat, if somebody's doing it right, it can be magic. I've heard the Taco Bell Snapchat is amazing.
Yeah, it's really funny, actually.
and that's, I think that that was the big surprise to me about Snapchat was, you know, Snapchat, it was like a little kid thing. You know, like, oh, you make the funny face or whatever. But somehow it tapped into something in all of us that was like, yeah, I kind of like being silly. I kind of like making myself into a unicorn that pukes a rainbow. And for brands to step out of, you know, this stuffiness and do stuff where they're just like drawing sloppily on the screen and stuff like that, that is opening them up to us in a way that they've never opened up to us before. And there's a magic to that.
Yeah. And I think it's this movement towards what I'm starting to see a lot in the advertising world, because I still do work a little bit in that world too, as well, is that a lot of the design firms and ad agencies are getting younger. And I think because of that, they're, you know, if we look at Facebook and even if we look at Instagram to a certain extent, there's a certain sense now that they take themselves a little too seriously. And you know, I think looking at the memorable ad campaigns over the last, you know, two decades, like we think about, you know, the Jack campaign with Jack in the Box, you know, what also pops to mind in my head is the Old Spice commercials with the myriad of just insanity that they've gone through with their ad campaigns. And even lately, one of the ones that caught my eye was, I believe it's Northern, the toilet paper company. Mm-hmm. But they were making fun of hipsters. And so what they did was they released a bunch, this commercial that was really long actually, that was talking about artisan toilet paper. and they were doing things like original birch and like unfinished. And it was really, really funny. It was hilarious. And it showed this, you know, bearded guy with the slicked back hair, like your typical hipster, like, you know, just carving away at this piece of redwood. It's really funny. And it showed this woman, you know, who had just used the toilet paper, and she sits down all gingerly because, you know, it's coarse toilet. It's basically tree bark.
Right.
And I thought it was really funny. And I thought that it was because how interesting can you possibly make toilet paper? You know what I mean? And at that point, you know what toilet paper does. So there's not really any unique technology that can go into a piece of paper that's going to make it revolutionarily different from any other piece of toilet paper you're going to use.
Right.
So how do you make your brand recognizable? You make something really, really, really funny that people will latch onto and share. And that's exactly what they did. And I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, I think that that's the advantage of these younger people getting into the advertising field. You know, like you have Gary Vaynerchuk's, his advertising firm. They're just looking at all these, like, he keeps plugging Musical.ly, which is like, just like a, I guess it's like a karaoke app or something. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. But just like looking for these new avenues,
mm-hmm.
it's so refreshing because for so long, advertising was about doing the same thing, doing it the same way, using the same, you know, like getting this down to a science. Now it's about experimentation because you know what? With the internet, you would think that we would have more analytics. But in reality, the more analytics you get on stuff like this, the less information you have.
Sure.
And look at our analytics on our on this podcast. I can tell you how many downloads we had. I can't tell you how many people listened to it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how long they listened. I can't tell you what age they are. I can't tell you what sex they are, what country they're in. All I can tell you is downloads. That's it.
Yeah.
And it's the same with social media, all these other things. You know, like Snapchat, there is no analytics. You just, you know, it's like, did people view this? Yes. And I think that's what people are loving about it is it's just, it's boiled it down to one thing mm-hmm. where it's like, did I get views? Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. And I think that that's funny that you say that because it goes back to one of the very early topics we spoke to on the podcast, which is how useless metrics are when it comes to certain social media platforms like Instagram, for example. The number of views and the number of likes is the only metric you have. I mean, unless you physically go through and look at every single like and every single view, you have no real clear idea about who your cross section is. You just know that it's being viewed. And I think in a lot of ways I'm starting to see that as more and more helpful. I originally thought that it wasn't because I cared so much about the data, but now because I don't focus so much on the individual pieces of data, I can just create content that I know will be seen, you know?
Right. And the thing about these analytics too is just like, how far can you dig into it really to get, you know, like, sure, even if I could tell you, like YouTube, I can tell you what sex and what age group and all of these other things. I can tell you all of that. But what mm-hmm. I can't tell you is whether people liked it, whether they were paying attention, what about it they connected with. You know, all of those things, those are the most important things. And those are the things you're never going to get without, you know, without interviewing your own audience.
Sure. How do you feel? I mean, because I know with your vlog, the views kind of spike and there's an ebb and flow to it. Have you found any useful morsels of data that allow you to figure out what works and what doesn't?
No. what I can tell you is this is what I've learned. When some people don't feel like watching, it seems like almost everybody doesn't feel like watching.
Wow, that's weird. That's got to be a timing thing. That's,
you know, and it's weird. There's a weird phenomena that I've been noticing. It keeps evolving and changing. You know, like I used to, people talk about the first 24 hours of YouTube video is the most important. And it definitely is. There's no doubt about that. But I've noticed that for my vlog in the last maybe 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
it's expanded to almost 36 hours. I will look and sometimes I'm like, whoa, I got like no views. And then I just, you know, move on. I'm on the next vlog. And then when I'm going through YouTube to do something else, I'll see everything all grouped together. And I'll see that one video that had like no views. And I'm like, whoa, that was the biggest video of the week. All of a sudden it got a ton of views, but it happened way after that initial 24 hours.
I think with vlogs, it's a little different. I mean, I think that the viral video thing definitely matters much more within the first 24 to 48 hours. But with vlogs, especially if your viewership is consistent, I think that people watch it when they can. Like I know with me and your vlog, for example, I typically end up not watching them on the days that they're published. I usually watch them, you know, I binge them two or three at a time, and I usually do it at the beginning or the end of the week. So I know that at least from that perspective, because the content, you can expect the content to come out at a certain time, that I have no real sense of urgency to watch it right away. So that actually makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, for example, like I'm looking at my YouTube right now, and I've got five of Casey Neistat's videos in the bank that I haven't watched yet, and two of Wheezy Waiters. So, you know, so like I'm doing it myself. And it's true. When you're putting out daily content, it's hard to believe that people are going to watch it every day. They might watch all of them, but they're not necessarily going to watch them every day. I try to, because it's really fun to, you know, check in, especially on Casey, and because he's inspiring. So just to see him once a day, it gets me going. But obviously, I've gone 5 days, so I'm not pushing too hard for that. Speaking of YouTube, that steers us into a topic I wanted to bring up. YouTube is building in a messaging app within, this actually relates to the Instagram thing too. Mm-hmm. And to me, this makes a huge amount of sense, because actually at one point I had tweeted YouTube and said, is there a way for creators on YouTube to communicate to each other better? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, some, like you've got your, especially in the vlog community, you've got your fellow vloggers. These are, you know, these are your, as I called it in my video, my YouTube gang. And you're checking out their stuff. You're helping them. They're helping you. They're checking out your stuff. But sometimes you need to communicate, and you don't want to do that in the comments of a video, you know, especially like if you're planning a collaboration or something. But you might not know these people well enough to be like, here's my phone number.
Sure.
So I, seeing that they're making a messaging app, I think that's huge, but I still think they need to work on the way the comments work. It's really, really hard to keep up with comments as a YouTube poster, unless you go straight up to the internet and you go to the video and scroll down, you know, like, and that's using all the notifications to keep up. It just doesn't work.
You know what I'm really curious about? Speaking of messaging, this is kind of off topic, but on topic in a weird kind of way too, is I'm curious as to which one of the viewing platforms, you know, Netflix, HBO Go, Amazon Prime, which one's going to have a live messaging feature first. The reason I'm really curious about that one is, I think something that's really missing from a lot of the experiences that we have with TV shows is the ability to sit in the same room with friends and watch something. You know what I mean? So I'm curious as to whether or not anyone's actually going to try that.
There was some, I can't remember what it was called. I think it was called Glue, and then it became something else. There was a sort of social media. It was an earlier time, so it might not have fit into that bubble. But essentially, you would follow people just like you do on a social media. But when you would watch a TV show, for example, all you could do on this thing was, I'm watching this or I'm reading this. Mm-hmm. And then you could talk back and forth with other people who were watching it or reading it at the time. And I think it was ahead of its time, but you're absolutely right. And if I were to put my money on it, I'd put it on Netflix. Netflix is they're the ones who's always ready to go into no man's land first. Everything everybody else has done has followed them.
Yeah, but I am still concerned for Netflix. I mean, Netflix is definitely one of those companies that's very similar to Facebook in the sense that we always make the natural assumption that they're always just going to be around. But I'm curious as to how far HBO Go and Amazon Prime are going to give them a run for their money when it comes to the future of you know, live stream or of streaming, just because I mean I know that the war is kind of brewing between everybody, and a lot of it has I'm frustrated. I remember one of the notes that I saw of yours, which is hilarious because this is all happening real time and I'm watching you move things in Trello. It's fascinating. It's one of the things that I actually wanted to talk to you about when I saw the original note, which was, you know, to this day, there is still no Amazon app for Apple TV. The Amazon Prime Video app still has no Chromecast support. And I wonder how much of a war is brewing in the background when it comes to how these streaming companies are ultimately going to, you know, drop the landscape when it comes to the content.
Oh, I wasn't aware that there was no Chromecast support. That's kind of strange, though. I mean, what competition is there?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess
Fire TV.
Maybe there's no Chromecast support. And also, which is weird because for Netflix there is Chromecast support, and YouTube there's also Chromecast support. So I don't know how or why Amazon's video team decided not to do that.
I think that they're making a lot of mistakes. Like that, the choice not to be on Apple TV for this long is stupid. I was actually literally just reading something maybe an hour ago where somebody was saying that they thought that the reason that Amazon had chosen not to do an Apple TV app wasn't for the same reason that everybody thought. Everybody thought it was like a big middle finger to Apple. In reality, what this person was saying, they thought it was about the percentage. Mm-hmm. You know, because Apple would take 30%. And looking at Amazon's track record with Apple, I believe that that's probably true because if you look at the Kindle app, you can't buy a Kindle book in the Kindle iOS app. You have to sign on to Amazon, buy it, and then go back to your phone or iPad, and now you can read it.
Well, I think that what Amazon is gearing themselves up to, and this is a lot of background stuff that a lot of people don't really pay attention to, but Amazon is one of the biggest cloud companies in the world. So a lot of the cloud backbones that a lot of companies operate on are Amazon clouds. Mm-hmm. And I think that what Amazon is attempting to do is forcing people into their ecosystem before the ecosystem exists. And I think that ultimately their goal is to create an ecosystem kind of like Apple's, where it's a one-stop shop and everything that you need to do from a productivity or entertainment perspective can all be done through an Amazon cloud. And right now, I think that they're preparing people for that, but I think they're jumping the gun because most of the tools and most of the avenues that you need for entertainment are not quite ready yet. You know, like even the Amazon Prime Video app, for example, is not a great app. Netflix's interface is definitely better. So I don't know. I don't know what that landscape's going to look like moving forward. But I definitely think that Amazon is trying to create an amalgam of all of these different ecosystems and create one kind of end all be all ecosystem that everyone will have to rely on for both productivity as well as for entertainment.
And I wonder, I mean, there's part of me that initially thinks that's dumb. And then another part of me is like, maybe it's smart. But ultimately, I think that this idea of forcing people into ecosystems from a narrow business point of view, it's very, mm-hmm. it's very smart. For a long term, it's very dumb. For example, not having that Amazon app on the Apple TV means I haven't watched a single thing on Amazon Prime since I got the Apple TV. Nothing. Yeah, not one show, nothing.
Mm-hmm. And I rely so much on my Chromecast that I will essentially live in, you know, and I have an Amazon Prime account and I paid annually, but I'm kind of regretting that now just because I don't use Amazon Prime Video or music because neither of them have Chromecast support and I'm using Chromecast so much for my other stuff. You know, I don't want to watch my Amazon Prime movies on my phone. And I also don't want to open it up in a browser window. And because you can actually still just Chromecast from a browser window from the Chrome browser itself. But I don't want to go through all that. I mean, I want to watch it on my phone. I control Netflix through my phone and I can Chromecast through my phone. So why not let me just do that if you're, you know, so that to me is a kind of a weird oversight. I'm not sure what Amazon's ultimate strategy is with that. But if they're gonna force people into an ecosystem, that ecosystem better exist.
There's a lot of, and that's why I think that like some of it is smart business choices, and some of it is just bad because there are certain things where I'm like, no, this is proof that they are not maniacal enough to have a beautiful plan. For example, like like just looking to like, okay, you want to watch a TV show in Amazon Prime, right? It pulls up the episodes a la carte, which is just like, if I type in, I go in and I type in, I don't know, Firefly. It's not going to just go, here's Firefly the show. And then I click on that and show me all the episodes. It's going to parse out every single episode. And I have to scroll through the interface. This is on their own website. Scroll mm-hmm. through the interface, go to the next page, go to the next page until I find the episode I want. And that's not good user interface in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, that's bad news.
And another thing that baffles me too is that YouTube's app on Apple TV, there's no way to like a video.
Mm-hmm.
That's the core feature of YouTube, is liking videos.
Yeah, that's kind of a surprise to me. I'm shocked that they didn't do that.
It's not like it would be hard. It's a two-button system. Like, dislike. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, it's very, very strange. I don't understand how or why that's the case with YouTube. Considering how and that has to be an Apple side thing, not a YouTube thing, because I think the folks over at YouTube are smarter than that. But I could be wrong. I don't know.
Here's what I think. I think that they're getting ready to phase out the thumbs up and thumbs down. The reason I say that is because I know for a fact that they've been focusing their analytics, not their analytics, I'm sorry. They've been focusing the way that you get featured as a YouTuber is based on a score. Mm-hmm. And the score used to be based on views and likes. Now it weighs heavily more on watch time and subscriptions. So a channel that has more subscriptions and longer watch time, it's based on percentage, obviously. So like if I have a 5-minute video and people only watch 30 seconds, I have a low score. But if I have a 5-minute video and 90% of my people watch all 5 minutes, I have a high score. And that's weighed more heavily than the likes. So I think they're moving to a TV ratings model.
Which in a sense to me seems a little bit smarter. But I also don't understand how then a user or a content creator can actually use that to gauge the success. I mean, what metric shows up on the actual video itself, if not likes or views?
Well, anybody that puts up a video, you have access to vast analytics. YouTube's analytics for the creators is vast. I can go into here. Let me click it right now, and I'll tell you all of the maybe not all of them. I'll tell you a few of the fields that you can see. I mean, I've already mentioned that you can see age, sex, but even the age group, it's broken into age groups. It gives you a percentage of your audience for that age group. Mm-hmm. So I have the first thing that pops up. This is just more proof for me. I click overview of analytics. The first analytic that pops up, it's watch time. Average mm-hmm. view duration is number two. Then comes views, then estimated revenue.
Gotcha.
So, I mean, when you break down in this, like I can see I have 77% of my viewers in the United States. I can see what browsers they're using. The analytics are insane in YouTube.
Mm.
But it's Google, so don't be surprised.
Do you find most of those analytics actually useful?
I don't get caught up in analytics. I feel like we're going back to what we were saying. It doesn't tell you as much as people think it does. You know, like, okay, I can say like my number one watch time for what is this? I don't know what the time period I'm looking at right here. For the last month, there it is. My top video is the one about Sarah and Colin's garage sale.
Yeah.
Now, am I supposed to say, oh, that means people like watching people's yard sales? Maybe. Does that mean that people like Sarah and Colin? Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Or could it just be that Joy and Sarah look beautiful in the thumbnail that I put up and people wanted to click on two beautiful girls? That's probably the likely one, but I can't say for 100%. And that's what I mean. Like, I don't get caught up in the analytics, because how much time do I have to really sit around and decipher all of that? I just stick to putting stuff up and moving forward.
And considering what your vlog is intended for, I'm sure that's ultimately it's not about that anyway. So that makes sense.
it's insane. I mean, these people get too wrapped up in this stuff. And then I think that when you get too wrapped up in analytics as a creator, it sets you up for disappointment because you're going to find that what you think you're interpreting, it's going to lead to disappointments because you're putting so much into it. And what you should be focusing on is whether you're making stuff you like.
Sure. And I think that's ultimately the thing too, is that if you focus too much on analytics, then you end up starting to whether you like it or not, you're going to pander. You know, that's just the nature of that. And I think that's the struggle that I keep trying to push through with Crystal, is that, you know, obviously she's not inherently a creative person when it comes to marketing or advertising. So she's very much focused on what her audience wants. And I keep telling her that at least on some level, it can't be about what your audience wants. It has to be about what you want. What would you watch? You know, what would you care about seeing if you're a part of your own demographic when it comes to what you're projecting for your sales, then you don't have to look any further for yourself to find the answer to those questions. You know, what video would compel you enough to watch it for a minute and a half, and what content would have to be contained within it to keep your interest and or to prompt you to keep watching content from that creator?
And that's the thing that's important for people to understand. I was actually literally just in a conversation about this with somebody in this Facebook group. And what I was saying is, like, you as a creator, you dictate what people see.
Sure.
They decide whether they want to watch it or not, but it's your job to lead, not to follow. It's your job to lead. Mm-hmm. And who you get to follow you, those are the people that you want. And the people who don't like it, you know, the people, like, going back to The Killing, people who didn't like The Killing, well, guess what? The show wasn't for them.
Sure.
And that's okay. Just like Lars von Trier, you know, people who like his movies, cool. Whoever they are, that's for them. And he's not going to make his next movie more palatable because I hated Antichrist and whatever.
Pyromaniac.
And that's because they're creators. And that's what you have to decide. Are you a creator or are you a marketer?
Yeah.
Because a marketer is nothing but analysis and all these things. But at a certain point, a marketer makes a choice too.
It's interesting that you put it that way. But that's very much the case. You know, I remember my design world, you know, in my early 20s when I was fresh and young and wanted to do design for the rest of my life, I remember at some point an art director asking me that same question, you know, are you into marketing? Are you into creating? Because those are two inherently different things. And at some point you have to choose one or the other because there's no real way to do both, and be successful at both. But his ultimate kernel of wisdom that stuck with me was, if you create original content that's really interesting to you, then it will be successful whether you like it or not. And I think that's an important point to keep for anyone out there who is creating content. You know, don't pander to an audience. Just create quality versions of what you like, and the audience will find you.
Absolutely. And one of your notes here is about how it literally says John Malkovich is an amazing weirdo. And
yeah.
Why? But we love John Malkovich. Those people who love John Malkovich love him because he's doing exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. He makes the movies. He picks the roles that he wants to do. He's not people aren't telling him, oh, well, we sure wish that you would play the president of the United States. He's not worried about that. He's worried about some weird, crazy role that he wants because he's a weirdo and he's happy with that. And that's the way we like him too.
And it's funny that you say that because I don't really think of John Malkovich when it comes to content creators, but you know, he's very much his own content creator in the sense that when I see Malkovich's name attached to a movie, the chances of me watching that movie have exponentially increased. You know, like, I think there's one out there. There's a movie called Rounders.
That's about, I was going to bring it up too.
Oh, really? You know, it's basically Matt Damon's journey through the underground seedy cash game poker world, and John Malkovich is this honor driven old school successful poker player, and he has like one of the worst Russian accents I've ever heard in my life in that movie. And this one line just sticks out to me. It's like, pay this man, he's Miani. And like, I'm like, dude, Malkovich, what accent is that? I don't even
flash the pots whenever the fuck I want.
Yeah,
it's so like almost Swedish at certain points.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't understand. I don't have.
But it's so good, though.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. Don't get me wrong; it's absolutely incredible. But you're right. Like it's because he's such a strange guy, and his projects are very much handpicked by him. So in a very defined way, he is a content creator, even though he is the both the creator as well as the participant when it comes to the content itself.
Yeah, and I mean acting is creation. You have to create a character, and you have to embody that. If you're a good actor. You have to embody that character. You have to bring them to life. And oftentimes, you know, a lot of people don't know, but these actors are building backstories of these characters that you're never going to know anything about. But they've built it up, especially if they're method actors.
Sure.
I don't think Malkovich is a method actor.
I don't know if he is.
I feel like I would know that if he was. What have you been watching?
I went and I watched... Civil War, Captain America, Civil War. And I feel about Civil War like I think you might have felt about Age of Ultron from the Avengers, in that it was probably one of the most fun movies I'd ever seen. I absolutely loved that movie, and I loved it on many levels. And I highly, in my opinion, thus far is the best Marvel movie in that collection. And that is saying something considering how much I liked some of the other movies.
Wow.
So that one's definitely on my list of, I mean, I thought Age of Ultron was pretty good, but Civil War just blows it out of the water. It is such a good movie. And, you know, it's a movie that is accessible by all ages, but still has an air of seriousness that adults can really gravitate towards. Because I think for me, that's where The Force Awakens kind of falls short, in that it's not really adult enough for me to take it seriously versus a movie like Civil War, which dealt with some very interesting social issues on top of being a very fun action movie. And it also injected humor in parts that I didn't think were possible in a movie as serious as it was. So I actually really, really liked it.
I'm chomping at the bit to see it, but I hate going to the theater.
Oh, I hear you. I had to go see it on a random Monday. There's no way. I steer clear of movie theaters on opening weekend like plague. So I didn't even attempt to see it on the opening weekend. I waited at least 4 days later.
But I did go to the theater recently. I went for Mother's Day because my mom wanted to go to see a movie. And the weirdest thing happened to me when I'm in there. I've never experienced this before, and it's just a symptom of modern times. I'm sitting, it's a small theater that we went to, and I'm sitting in my seat, and there's like two rows in front of me, and then there's that gap, you know, there's always a gap of seats for the walkway. There's the gap, and then there's people down there, and then two rows in front of that gap, there's this woman, and she's watching television on her phone while we're waiting for the movie to start, which is fine, you know, whatever, but it's kind of trippy, like mind blowing, where I'm like, she's watching TV waiting for a movie. But then I realize that she has it loud enough and the screen is big enough that I can watch too. And she's watching Bones, which is a show I enjoy. But then I realize that she's watching episodes from this current season, which I haven't started watching yet. And I realize that I am trapped in this seat and this woman is quite possibly about to ruin a season of a TV show for me because I can't not hear it. And as much as I'm trying to listen to, you know, the people around me talk and stuff like that and not look at the screen, of course, that's what my brain wants to hear. My brain wants to see. And that is a weird, weird experience.
Wow, that's interesting. I guess that makes sense, though. I mean, I'm shocked that you didn't have headphones in. That's kind of odd. What movie did you end up going to see? What'd you guys watch?
Mother's Day. That was what the movie was called.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea that was even a movie.
Me neither. It wasn't half bad, considering that I expected it to be 50 times worse. It was kind of funny. I don't know. Nothing I want to talk about. But what I do want to talk about comic book wise, though, is so you remember I complained about that Justice League cartoon?
Mm-hmm.
And how, oh, I didn't complain, but I said it wasn't as good as the Marvel Avengers cartoon. Mm-hmm. I have to eat a little bit of crow on that, because the second season of that was pretty fantastic. Like, there was a few episodes of this Justice League cartoon that I found myself looking up at the screen going, whoa, is this for kids? And it was very well written and very dramatic. And, yeah. And I'm at a loss for words. It just kind of blew me away. And then because of that, I started watching the Flash TV show. And I don't know why. I just think I just saw it and I clicked it. And it's really good too. Like, really good. Yeah. I mean, I'm addicted to it. And
yeah, I'm shocked. I actually really liked it too.
It's something about it. There's something.
Tell these stories to ourselves. He makes a reference earlier to getting over his bad self. You know, we have these stories that we tell ourselves that maybe aren't the best stories, that don't really lead us to down progressive paths in our lives. So how do we know the best way to tell our story? He may be talking about the story that you're writing for fiction, but we're not going to answer that today. So, Lam, you want to start? I know you had some thoughts on that when we first saw this question.
My thoughts on it have changed dramatically since the time I originally saw the question, and it's based on two pieces of incredible artistry that I've seen since. The first one is the documentary that I recommended to you yesterday. It's called Faces Places. At least that's the horrible American translation of it. it's horrifying. The French version of the name I'm not even going to try to pronounce. But basically,
Visage Village.
Yeah. But there's a cool French nuance to that I'm not even going to attempt. It's an amazing, amazing documentary by a fantastic Belgian filmmaker that I highly recommend anyone. Basically, she enlists the help of a street installation artist / photographer, this French guy, and they travel the French countryside in a giant van made up to look like a huge camera. That prints enormous prints out of the side of the van. And it's amazing how people who have never really had art in their lives in any present way experience those moments in which they see giant pictures of themselves plastered on the sides of buildings and the things that come up for them, you know, seeing the lines in their own faces, you know, seeing the scars that they've accumulated over their lifetimes. And I don't think I've ever seen a more sincere documentary, because most documentaries, I mean, if you watch documentaries at any length, most of them, you know, have a thesis. The narrators try to stay out of the storytelling process, even though their presence is definitely very clear throughout, because there's always typically some kind of slant to every documentary. This documentary doesn't feel like a documentary at all. It feels like a documentary basically about itself. It's what you want a reality show to be, basically. And you see these people talk about their lives, and the one through line, whether it's a happy story or a melancholy story, the one thing that you sense throughout is that there's just a hopeless sincerity in that moment, because they're caught so off guard by this massive camera. The wonderment of it opens up their defenses. You know, it takes down all of these walls that they've built over whatever period of time they've built them, and it makes it so that they tell the much more honest versions of their stories. And the second, so for anybody, please go out there and watch that documentary. The second thing that defines that aspect of telling your own story to me is Cheryl Strayed. You know, because of the episode that we did, and because of the things that I've read about her and the things I've read of her, the through line through all of these, whether it's that documentary or any of Cheryl Strayed's work, or actually any real great work in that sense, is the honesty. It's all about the sincerity and the honesty, and the ability to take that honesty with the skills that you have as an artist, and the confidence that you gain with age and wisdom, to tell that story unrelentingly and very truthfully. And so that for me is the quintessential answer to that question. How do you tell your own story? Well, tell it honestly and let everything else fall as it may.
And I think that a lot of that begins with the process of questions. We spend a lot of time projecting answers out into the world with just the way we talk to each other. We're not really listening to each other. We're projecting opinions. Just listen to two people talk about their cell phones. And you'll notice that the two people are slowly trying to convince the other person that their phone is the better choice and that they should have bought that cell phone, that you should have Android instead of iOS. And it's just – I think it's a consequence of consumerism. Long exposures to consumerism leads to kind of thought process like that. It's not surprising. But questions – I would suggest, Mateo, to in order to find the honesty and the genuine authenticity, well, those are redundant, but we'll just put a comma between those, that Lam is talking about, is begin with questions. Begin with questions not only for yourself, but for people around you. Instead of telling people things, start asking them things. When somebody says something that you don't agree with, ask them to clarify. Ask them what they really mean. Not because you're trying to accomplish anything, but just try to understand exactly what they're saying. You don't have to spend your life defending what you believe. If you believe something, you believe it. You don't need to project that into the world. And that's this problem we all have, is we feel that we need to defend our beliefs. Why can't we just carry them around? This is what I believe. And be fascinated by the differences from other people. And I think you're going to find that your story lives in those differences. The similarities are the things that are what we should focus on. But we should also celebrate the differences as well. And the way to understand those differences is to just really understand them. To understand what you believe, ask yourself questions. What do I think about this? Why do I think that? Where does that come from? Continually, just make it a continual stream of questions to ask yourself. Your story is not in the answer. Your story is in the questions. The story of our life is in the questions that we ask ourselves and that we ask of the world around us. It is not in the answers, because the answers are guesses. The questions are the concrete things. The questions are things that don't change. They just grow. We have more of them. But the questions are always there. They always stand. What is the meaning of life? What does this person believe? How does that affect me? What should I do about hunger? What about war? These questions, those are the solid things of life. Those are the stories. And the ones that we pay attention to define who we are as human beings. But the answers that we project are just us letting our ego bleed into the world. If you can learn to live outside of your own needs and your own worries, you'll find that your story is floating around everywhere. You don't need to find it. It's already there. Your story is the thing that you've been ignoring. It's the thing that you've been shutting out. It's the thing that the reason we pull our phones out of our pocket all the time instead of spending time in silence, because our story is there and maybe we don't want to accept that there is a story there. We don't want to live in that. That's my thoughts on it.
And you know, the other side of that too, I think a lot of the reason why people are afraid of that, I know that I was, and so I'm going to, I don't know how many more people this applies to. I don't want to make the assumption that it applies to everyone. But some of the reason why that happened for me is because I was scared of the bad times. I was scared of the worst versions of me. I was scared of the perception that people had of me when I wasn't at my best. And so I think, and we've talked about this on numerous occasions too as well. I think two things are very crippling here. The first thing is shame. And the second thing is pride. And I think they walk hand in hand when it comes to this. And you've said this a billion times too as well, which is most of those things are purely ego-driven. You know, most of those things are exist because, or those two things exist because you have a perception of yourself that you've wanted to maintain or you've wanted to build over a period of time. And sometimes you falter from that. And only recently, and this is, I'm talking about in the last like maybe year of my life, have I gotten okay with the idea of having made mistakes, of having not been the best version of myself, and of realizing that those darker moments or those difficult moments or those moments in which I felt a sense of shame towards things that I did or who I was are totally okay. It's part of life. It's part of experiencing life with other people. And I had to come to terms with those things in order to become a better person and a better artist. Because without being honest about the bad parts, you can't really be honest about the good parts either.
I had the pleasure on this trip of having some very deep and powerful conversations. And without sharing people's deep, dark secrets or even their names, one of the things that we talked about was guilt about the past. Somebody who felt like there's things that they should have done that they didn't. And it felt impossible to change that. And in the time that we spent talking, what we discovered was the problem here with shame is, as, and you're right, I have said that it's ego, but there's also something else to it as well. When we're dealing with shame, when we're dealing with regret, we're setting ourselves up for the impossible. We're dealing with the past, things that you've done in the past. And when you're focusing on those things, those are things that will never change. They've already happened. They're literally things that are gone, that can never be fixed or changed because they've happened already. You can't go back and adjust them. You never, when we all know that, this isn't like some revelation. But when we're focusing on those things, we're setting ourselves up for an impossible challenge because we're going, in our minds, we're deciding, how can I fix the thing that is completely unfixable? How can I change the thing that is unchangeable? We don't have the past. It's gone. All we have is now and tomorrow. So you have to let that challenge go. You have to let go of the challenge of the past and accept that that's the way things are and figure out what you're going to do now and what you're going to do tomorrow. Because if you're carrying that shame, all you're doing is you're beating yourself over the head with yesterday. And yesterday is a petrified piece of wood. It's never going to come back to life, ever. You need to accept that. And that's how we start our story is by, you know, they always say the best way to write a fictional story is to start midstream. And what I mean by that and what they mean by that is a good story starts in the middle of the action. Things are already happening. We don't want to hear 25 minutes of backstory and hear all about the character's youth just so we can hear about his wedding day. Start me on the wedding day. And then find a way to tell me about the past in little ways throughout that story if it's important. But start me in the action. That's how we have to live our lives. We're already in the action. We're in the middle of it. Our story starts now. And now. And now. It didn't start in the past because that story is already told. So you want to know a way to tell your story is to let go of the other ones that you're carrying around and start writing one now, today, the second, and write another one tomorrow and another one, and always be moving forward. Don't hold on to that heavy brick of the past. It's just going to make it sink to the bottom of the ocean. There's no story in that. Okay, let's do Allison's question, because the poor thing has probably been waiting 2 months to hear an answer to this question. And this one is kind of directed more towards me, but I'm going to ask for your input at every step of this, because you are, as always, I say at the beginning, my partner. So Allison asked me to clarify. I had mentioned earlier that every night I do a nightly inventory. So she had asked me to tell what that nightly inventory is. And it has changed a little bit, but I cut out some of the stuff that I was doing at that time, and I've only included the stuff that I do now. And I unfortunately have gotten out of the habit of doing this every night, especially being out of town, but I want to get back into it. Anyways, I diverge. My nightly inventory is essentially, going back to questions, it is a series of questions that I ask myself at the end of the night to end my day. Typically, I do this about an hour before I go to bed because I like to have just kind of drifting, you know, like Lamb's Happy 30 Challenge. I like to have time that doesn't involve anything else, including questions. And usually a lot of what I pull out of these questions is what I end up thinking about for like that last hour before I go to sleep, much of which is spent in the dark in bed because it takes me a while to fall asleep. So the questions that I ask myself, and I'm going to stop at every question, Lam, and have you give your thoughts on each. The first one I ask myself is, what did I learn today? I think that going back to what you were saying earlier, being present and paying attention to things around us and stuff like that, it's important to remember that you learn something every day. And, you know, it could be ridiculous things. It could be life-changing things, like I learned today that I'm a selfish person. Or I learned today that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams hated each other with a passion. Who knows? So I like to just think about the things I learned for that day. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do something similar. Except I split the question off into a couple of different things. You know, like for example, I make it a very big point to find out about a piece of artwork or something that I need to consume, whether it's, you know, a show or a documentary, a movie, whatever it may be, a song. So one of the questions I ask myself is, you know, did I find something cool today? So that's definitely part of it for me too as well. I do ask myself if I learned something, but I've kind of abandoned that question just because I feel like I'm pretty rabid about consuming information in the world. So I learn quite a bit every day. At least I'd like to think that I do. So I think I've asked that question enough to make it so that I never don't have that as a priority in my life. I'm always trying to learn something.
Yeah, I think for me, the reason it's important for me is probably going to what you said, that we learn so much in the day. And typically I keep this down to usually just a list of three things. I don't try to remember everything because obviously you can't. But it's important for me to acknowledge those things, to remember them, because sometimes I forget that I learned them. And I find that sometimes I get to this list and it's hard. And I actually have to start dialing through the day, like, okay, then I did this, then I did, oh, I learned a lesson there. And sometimes I find I pull things out where it's like, oh, I learned that when I smile at this person that they smile back. And the things that I didn't realize that I learned. So for me, and it could just be the difference in the way our brains work, but for me, it's valuable for me to force myself to re-experience those things.
You know, maybe it's smart. It would be smart for me to, because, you know, I can't make the arrogant assumption that I just learn a lot every day. But I can modify that question to fit my purposes, which is, what thing did I learn today that I didn't expect to learn?
That's a good one. I like that. The next question I ask, and this is a very short one, but I find this is important. What purchases did I make today? I find that's really important because with Amazon and all this stuff and iTunes, you know, oh, apps and random things, if I don't pay attention to where my money goes, I notice that it goes away. And that's a pretty basic one. Do you do something similar, Lam?
To a point, I actually made a choice about maybe 3 months ago to not buy anything. So I have pretty strictly stuck to just utility stuff, necessity stuff, and the only luxury items I really allow myself are things that will give me experiences, so like a ticket to something or you know, something like that. So I will spend money on food, I will spend money on drink, I will spend money on experiences, but like with clothing, for example, I haven't purchased a single piece of clothing in over 8 months. And I'm pretty damn proud of that, actually. And it actually goes way back to a conversation we had many, many months ago about minimalism. And so I've literally just not purchased a single item of clothing in that period of time. And now, because I've trained myself so long to not do it, I, I don't even miss it. And it physically irks me when I even consider having to buy a piece of clothing. I just, you know, and I know that this is probably true for most people who live in the United States and who are doing reasonably well. Even for those who don't, I have friends who aren't doing financially well who have a ton of clothes. You have so much more than you need, and you don't realize that until you make the concerted effort to not get any more.
Yeah, I find it's important to do exactly that, to keep me in check, because I haven't actually, I don't even remember the last time I bought clothes. Any clothes that have come into my life in the last year were gifts. The only thing that I can think is I finally bought a pair of new shoes, which, if any of you listen to my short-lived solo podcast, I talked about my need to keep shoes until I can accept that they're actually dead. So I finally bought a new pair of shoes, and that was because I needed black Converse for this wedding, and I decided that it was a good double purchase. I needed them for the wedding, and I needed new shoes, and I like Converse. So, but yeah, I found that before I did that, I was probably stacking up little purchases here and there, but now when I see it in front of me, I realize what I'm consuming, and I didn't even make the subconscious connection that you made there, which is that, yes, that's because I want to be more minimal. And until I can see where my money is going, I can't really put a wrap on that. I can't keep it handled because, oh, I bought this, I bought this. Until I see those things confronted in front of me and I go, oh, confronted in front of me. Wow, that's a nice alliteration. until I can see where these things are, you know, like I said, there's all these little invisible things that we buy. Until I can start clamping down on those, I could never begin to be a minimalist. So that was a huge thing for me to start doing that, because that's how I got to the point that we're talking about. I was like, oh, I bought that. Damn it. Why did I buy that? that regret. Okay. So the next question is, and this is I probably should have put this later because this is a heavy question, but this is a very important question for me, and it goes back to what I said a few minutes ago about living outside of your own needs. What did I do for other people today? What did I do that had nothing to do with me or my ego? What did I do for someone else solely for that person or people? That's an important question for me to ask every day because it keeps me that's why I call this my nightly inventory. I need to see, do I have stock in other people? Because if I don't, then am I really alive?
Wow, that's a tough one. That's a great one. I'm going to incorporate that into my nightly inventory as well. That's a great one. I mean, my version of it was, what did I do to change the world today? But I think that your version of it is more succinct, in that in order to change the world, you have to change people. And in order to change people, you have to consciously choose to have an effect on them. Wow, that's a powerful one. That is a very powerful one. And I think that especially as I get older and older, I have such a strong desire to help people. Like a lot of the projects I'm taking on right now, for example, I almost irk at the possibility of getting credit for them. I know that sounds strange, because in my youth, I probably would have cared about getting credit for them more than the actual thing itself. But these days, I just want the work to be done. You know, I want the effect of the work to be felt. And I want the legacy of the work to stand by on its own without the attachment to my name even. I mean, don't get me wrong. This is not to say that I don't have a sense of pride about being able to accomplish certain things with my work or the things I do to help people. But I just don't care. It feels dirty almost to ask for credit for things or to receive praise for things that I feel like I do because they're the right thing to do and not because I want credit for them. So, yeah, that's an interesting one. I really like that.
Yeah, I find it's important to acknowledge when you do things right. You know, like you said, the reason that this question exists is to make sure that you're doing these things. And I'm sure somebody could probably interpret exactly what Lamb's saying you don't want to do there, which is this isn't, you know, you guys aren't taking a nightly inventory because you're trying to look at these awesome things I did for other people. It's literally, did I do something for other people? And when you pay attention to those little things, then you, it's just like one of the other questions we'll talk about in a little bit. When you pay attention to certain things, they grow in your life. You know, what you focus on, we've said this before, what you focus on is what you're going to get. You know, what you look for is what you will find. So if you're paying attention to the things that you do for other people, then you will find that you do more things for other people. And that's, like Pam said, that's how you change the world. You change the world by changing, by helping and caring for people around you. And if you aren't paying attention to that, then you're living in yourself. And if you're miserable, that's probably why you're miserable, because we are not self-sustained creatures. The next question, kind of in some way goes hand in hand with that, is what can I improve? Now, this question I ask myself, I used to ask the question is, where did I fail today? But then the slant of that question really changed the answer, and I didn't like the answers that I was getting because everything was negative. What can I improve? Now, this can be something very simple as looking and seeing that I didn't do anything for anybody today and going, well, I can pay attention to other people's needs. But it can also be something simple as looking at, wow, when I take these files, it takes forever for me to convert these JPEGs into PDFs, and I have to do this every Wednesday. How can I automate that? You know, is there something that I can drop these files into a folder and it will automatically convert all JPEGs that I drop into that folder into PDFs? You know, looking for little ways to improve your life in every way, whether it's personal or whether it is just flow, you know, fixing the mechanics of your life as well. What can I improve? Oh, I always forget to get gas before the week, my work week begins. Oh, well, I can improve that by setting myself a reminder the day before that goes off at a specific time and getting off my butt and going to the gas station. Lamb, do you do anything like that?
Yeah, I definitely do something like that. But for me, it's about the question's a little different because I think I've modified. Okay, let me start from the beginning here. A couple of months ago, I realized that there were a couple of things that were making it very difficult for me to do all of the things that I wanted to do throughout the course of the day, and it all came down to efficiency. It all came down to what you're talking about, which is, you know, I'd have panic moments where I would need to do something in the moment because I'm reacting to not having done it or not having prepared for it properly in order to get it out of the way, to leave myself the room and the energy and the time to do the things that I really wanted to do. So the question for me, it's not a nightly question, but it's a weekly question, is what can I do to free up more time and energy? And that is something that I constantly keep stock of, you know, from little things like how I cook food and how I eat, to things like where I park my car and when, for work, you know, what time I make phone calls, there's such a myriad of things that goes into that you'd be shocked at how much automating certain parts of your life really has a dramatic effect on how much time and energy that you have to do other things. The less you have to think about a repetitive task, the more effective you are at all of the things that you do want to do. For example, why should you have to think about something like getting gas or making food? I mean, those are parts of your daily life. It's not a reinventing of anything. It's just doing something to get it done. So it only stands to reason that you find the most efficient way to do it so that you can do something with the extra time and the energy that you have. And even though you're only saving 2 minutes here or 5 minutes there, or 30 seconds there, at the end of your night, when you sum up all of the amount of time that you're doing, you spend doing these other things, you've probably freed up an hour and a half of your life. And it's weird to think of it that way, but in doing what I've done over the last couple of months, it's very clear how much time I waste on inefficiency. And I think that that's a fantastic lesson for me, and a great lesson to for everyone else out there too, is to think about your tasks. I mean, think about the things that you do every day or every week and try to cut down the amount of time and energy you spend doing them as much as possible, so you can go and do taste tests with chips and write in your journal and do something creative or take a picture or appreciate a day for what it is. I mean, all of these things are enriching in ways that you can't quantify until you've actually done them. And over a long enough period of time, if you start doing these things, you cut these inefficiencies out of your life. It opens up your brain to being able to help people more, to see the plights of the world, and to appreciate your friends and to appreciate the people you care about. And you will be so much less miserable. You'll be I can't say that you'll be happy, because that's purely up to you and what your definition of happiness is. But what you will be is more at ease. You'll be less stressed. You'll have less anxiety. And I think that's where all of this came from for me, was a quest to remove as much anxiety from my life as possible.
And another aspect of the question that I totally forgot about too is what you're going to realize if you were to ask yourself this question too, is sometimes it is about those failures that I talked about. You know, like I lost my temper with this person. So what can I do to improve that? And what's really, really at the core of all of these questions, or maybe any question in life, is to really dig deep enough. And sometimes that means that an answer requires another question. So I lost my temper with this person. That's something I want to improve. So I have to ask myself why I lost my temper with that person. And what I find really useful is to ask yourself questions at least three deep. And what I mean by that, for example, I need a new phone. I don't, but I'm just throwing that out as a subjective thing. This is something that somebody might be thinking. Next question you need to ask yourself, or the first question you need to ask yourself, is why do I need another phone? And so maybe your answer is because this one is old. Okay, so why is it important to get something new when this is old? And the answer to that might be, well, because it's slow and it can't do everything that I need it to do. And okay, so the next question is, what do you need it to do? So you just keep digging, and what you end up, you say, well, I need it to do this, I need it to do this, and I need it to do this. Okay, now, is this $800 phone over here any more capable of doing it than this one over here? You're going to find these different dilemmas, and obviously, most of the time we all buy the same price level of phone. So that's probably not the best example of price level differences. But for example, somebody might say, I need a new phone. And then the question is, why do I need a new phone? And say, because it saves me time. Ooh, really? So then the next question is, why do you need to save more time? And then the answer to that one is real magic, because the real magic would be because I use my time inefficiently. So your problem isn't your phone. Your problem is how you manage your time. So very interesting dynamic change right there when you go deep with questions, because you might find out that your problems aren't what you think your problems are.
That's almost always the case, by the way.
Oh, yes. Almost always. Why did I lose my temper with this person? You're going to start out that question thinking that it's their problem, that, you know, it's their fault. And what you're going to find out most time is it your problem? It's your fault. Next question, which arguably is the most important question on this list. The only other question that competes with it is, what did I do for others today? And this is, what am I grateful for today? Our favorite phrase recently, I've noticed on this podcast, is saying, we've talked about this before, but this is something that we have hammered into you guys, hopefully to the point where you guys get it, that gratitude is the most important thing that you can bring into your life if you want to make your life better. And so I force myself to think of at least three things, and I make sure that every day that they are three different things than I thought of the day before. And today it's like, last night it would definitely be, I am grateful to be back in my own bed. That was one of them. Now today, when I do this, I'm not going to talk about my bed today. I'm going to find three different things. And I'm sure you do gratitude every day as well, Lam.
Oh, absolutely. That's something that you introduced into my life a long time ago, and I've every night. It's weird because I've broken it down beyond that too. What am I grateful for? What am I grateful for is definitely a part of it, but I have the who am I grateful for too as well. And that's a separate question altogether. And I started out, naming a bunch of people in my life that I was grateful for, and I changed that so that it's now what one person today am I grateful for and why? And thinking about my relationship with that person and why it's benefited my life. That's my modification on it. And I find that one makes me much more present with the people I really care about. You know, it makes you really interested in their lives, and it makes you more conscious about the effect that you have on them even.
That's an important distinction. And I want to remind you guys, that's why for me, this is a nightly inventory. These inventories are a focus on the day that I just had. I'm not saying it's not important to be grateful for things in the larger part of your life, but try to focus on what happened the day that just ended, you know, that's coming to an end when you're doing this. And because it is important to acknowledge those things, it's nice to say, well, I'm really grateful for having a family that loves me. Right. We know that everybody is, but you're not really focusing on gratitude. The power of gratitude lies in specifics. And what I mean by that is, you know, saying, oh, I'm grateful for my family. That's not very specific. How about I'm grateful for the generosity of my mother? Now, that's very specific. And the reason that it's important to focus on those specifics is because the purpose of this gratitude is not just to acknowledge it, but to feel it, to experience it. Because when you re-experience it, you're teaching these things in yourself to grow. You're teaching this feeling of gratitude to grow, because when you live in a sense of gratitude, you're a happier person because it takes you outside of yourself. When you live too much inside yourself, as was mentioned a few minutes ago, you're miserable, because that's when you start becoming a hypochondriac, start getting anxiety, all of these things, become suicidal. It's focusing on yourself too much. It's all internal. So this is teaching you to look external and to let that blossom. So be specific. You know, what am I grateful for today? You know, I could say I'm grateful for this podcast today. That's not very specific, because Lam and I do this every Wednesday. I'm grateful that Lam and I got to talk about gratitude on the podcast today and share that with the world. That's awesome. And it's specific, you know, or I'm grateful that when I asked this question, Lam took it in this direction that I hadn't even thought of, because I learned something when I thought I was sharing something, I ended up learning something. These are very important things. And the purpose of all of this inventory is just to do exactly what Lam said. This is all about keeping you present. You couldn't run a business if you didn't know your inventory, right? Or you couldn't run a successful business if you didn't know your inventory.
I was
going to
say, I know plenty of people who run unsuccessful businesses that way.
But that's the purpose of this. You know, you keep yourself, you want to know where things are. You want to, and this is how you can grow and change things and improve things. And this is all related to creativity as well, because as we have harped on many, many times, the happier you are as a human being, the more caring and generous you are as a human being, the better your art becomes, because your art is not egotistical, and it's not focused in your own self, which is something that other people would have trouble experiencing. You're able to create things that the world can also share. Okay, and the next question is, and this we have made mention of this before as well, and maybe you'll understand why we mention these things before, because I think of these things every night, and Lam does as well. And the question here is, what goals have I made progress on? Happiness in life comes from making progress, guys. It doesn't come from accomplishment. It comes from the feeling of making progress, from moving forward. Like Lam has been kind enough to tell you guys multiple times, small goals. Set small goals, you know, progress. You know, if you're doing a bigger project, make smaller achievable goals so that you can feel that progress, that you're moving forward. So when you set that. What's also predicated in this question that it maybe isn't clear right away is that you know what your goals are. So if you're going to do this as a nightly inventory question, you need to have a list of your life goals. And there could be short-term life goals, long-term life goals, medium-term life goals, but have a list of those things. I have in my Apple Notes, I have a list of my life goals, and some of them are you would probably laugh at because they're so large and audacious, but they're there because I feel them and I need to know if I'm moving forward on those. And every day I look at what I've done and did I move forward on any of them? You know, whether it is just finishing this novel, that's a medium-term goal. Did I do any work on that novel today? I did. Good. There's progress on that. I want this podcast to be enormous, that people are all listening to this podcast and becoming creative human beings and changing the world. Did I make progress on that today? Well, I did record an episode. So yes, that's progress on that. Acknowledge those goals, but have those goals first.
Yeah, I mean, that's so critical. I mean, otherwise, all of these questions, all of these inventory things that we're talking about really have no long-term effect. You're just kind of wandering in the wind. Because I think, especially for where you and I are now, the questions are crafted to fit those goals. You know, how much closer, they're almost like milestones or check-ins with ourselves to make sure that we're still headed in the right direction. At least that's the way it feels for me.
Right. How can you navigate without having an idea where you're going?
Of course.
You know, you don't, when we use the Maps app, we don't just open the Maps app and go, I wonder where I'll end up. We put it at destination and then we hit the route button. If you don't have a destination, The route means nothing. Hmm. Okay. And the last question that I asked myself, and this is a small one, but it is in chronological terms, the last thing that I ask myself every day is, what do I need to know for tomorrow? It's very simple. It's just, what's going on tomorrow? I need to look at my calendar. I need to look at my tasks. I need to see if tomorrow's somebody's birthday. All of these things. What do I need to know? And it could go in different directions other than just that type of stuff. But prepare yourself mentally in some way for the day that's about to come. Then your morning won't feel, you know, you can wake up in the morning instead of having to grab your phone right away. You can just kind of experience your morning because you kind of already know.
It's funny that you say that because I also added that secondary part too as well. What's the first thing I need to do every morning? That's a pretty critical one for me because the reason I added it was because for a period of time I wasn't doing that and I felt like I was waking up every morning slightly panicked and that was not a good way to start.
Exactly.
Anxiety begins, you know, whatever emotion you have at the very beginning of your day. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not to say that you can't shake it, but it's so much harder to shake it if you start out on the wrong foot.
Exactly. And and to be honest, for some reason, I mean, we're very susceptible in the morning. We're just woke up. We're very vulnerable and we're in a vulnerable state of mind. So, you know, the wrong email or something can just veer us in the wrong direction. So if you can mitigate a lot of that to the night before, when you're at a different state, you're in a more relaxed state, hopefully, or you're about to have a relaxing time after you do this inventory, because you know you're prepped for everything, that you've cleared out the day and prepped for the next day. Then when you wake up in the morning, you're in a different mindset. You know that stuff is floating around subconsciously, but maybe now you can go in the shower and just remember what it feels like for the water to touch your body instead of going, okay, I need to send this email, I need to do that. You already kind of know that stuff. So that's an important thing. The way you experience your day, because like I said, you know, these are things we're going to ask each other at the end, or each other, we're going to ask ourselves at the end of the day. So how you experience the next day is going to affect how you answer the next day's questions. So the tomorrow and today are connected in that sense. So it's important to clear out the day that you're in and to prepare yourself for the next one. And it could be something, and that's how you don't do stupid things like, I forgot my wallet. You know, you make sure you go, what do I need to know for tomorrow? I need my wallet. Okay, well, let me put that somewhere where I will not miss it. Maybe I'll put it in the pants that I'm already going to wear tomorrow and put those pants on the chair.
Yep, I literally do that.
Okay, well, we've gone a little bit long, but I think that this has been a pretty valuable episode. There's first of all, actually, before I go any further, thank you to Mateo and thank you to Allison for asking questions and asking very, very good questions. Mateo, once again, if you were asking about fiction, let me know and we will talk about that in a different episode. But if you guys feed us questions and questions like this, particularly awesome questions, but even small questions, hey, what app is this, whatever, hey, we'll answer them because, you know, it's fun. And we get to go in different directions because now you guys are participating. And it's not just about Lam and I steering the boat. You know, you guys are on the ship too. So keep those questions coming. Lam, do you have closing words you would like to share with the audience? Would you like to sing us a song?
I'm not going to sing a song today, although I may do that at some point in the future. I mean, I guess throughout this entire podcast, the entire episode, what we've been continually going back to is the need to be present in our lives with not just the tasks we're doing, but, you know, just the world in general. You know, appreciate the small things and the big things and the all things that are around you and the people that are around you and what you can do to make their lives better. And the best way to do that is to cut out these devices from your life from time to time or for periods of time in order to make sure that you can, you know, smell the proverbial roses. So I guess if there's any words of wisdom I can impart on all of you out there, it's to turn off and tune in. We'll be right back.